This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.
Adventures with Words is brought to you by Audible. Try Audible free for 30 days and download any audiobook for free. To start your free trial, go to www.adventureswithwords.com/audible.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Adventures with Words, where we explore storytelling in all its forms. I'm Rob.
I'm Kate.
And this is our creature feature, where we discuss our favourite creatures, cuddly and cute to slimy and scary from the movies. But first this week, we were lucky enough to go to a talk by Terry Rawlings, an acclaimed film editor. He worked on films such as Alien and Alien 3, Chariots of Fire, Blade Runner, Legends, and finishing his career in 2005 with Phantom of the Opera.
The talk was hosted by Signals Media Centre in Colchester, and during his talk he spoke about a lot of the different films he'd worked on, some of the ones we've just mentioned. He actually started his career editing the sound rather than the picture, then moved into that with Alien, and he really sort of went into a lot of detail about the different people he'd worked with. It was really fascinating, actually. So hopefully you'll enjoy listening to some of the extracts, Terry talking about his life and his work.
I kept on doing all these sound pictures, which I was loving, but I was also thinking to myself, I could do this editing. I'm sure I could do it as well as the people I'm working for. And being as I was doing the sound, I knew how I could find things to give myself a chance to do a better soundtrack. So I carried on doing what I was doing with all these different directors, which was very good for me. And I eventually then arrived at Ridley Scott, and I was asked to do The Duelists, his first film, which was a wonderful film to do because Ridley, as you all know so well, has this fantastic eye, and everything you saw was beautiful to look at. So, working with Ridley Scott on that film, and when we finished Water It Down, I got a call from Ridley Scott's office. And it was saying that he's about to make this film called Alien, and he wondered whether I'd like to do the sound. And I said, no, I don't want to do the sound. I said, I want a couple of pictures. So he said, well, you better go and meet the producers and see what they say. So we met these people, and they were more interested in Water It Down. They said, oh, we really enjoyed the film. So I said, when it was about to leave, I said, well, can I do the film? And they said, of course. Well, can you imagine how you feel? It's a wonderful feeling when someone says, yes, you can. And so, we did Alien. Now, Ridley's on his second film, I'm on my second film, and we never left the cutting room ever. It was like we were working 24 hours a day, and it was just a fantastic exercise in how, to frighten someone to death. You tried to work out how far can you push someone in the corner before you let them off the hook, and you could only go so far. It was a very difficult film to present to anybody until it was finished, because all the wind machines and all the noise that was going on, you could never show it to people. They were all silences. And if you think about Alien, it's in slow motion. Basically, Alien is in slow motion. Nothing really moves fast. Everything, you creep around the ship, you creep around and something happens, and then you creep on again. And it's basically slow motion with shots. And to try and show this to someone without any sound on it is terrible. You're sitting there saying, Christ, when's something going to happen? As soon as you've got the sound going, you could really frighten them with the sound. You supplemented this thing. So that we spent a lot of time doing the sound as well as the picture. Then Alien 3. Alien 3 was nothing but troubles from the start. I mean, it was with David Fincher doing the first film with David Fincher. It was great working with him because he is a tremendous talent, as you will prove, as he's proved. But because it was his first film, they're giving him this film to do with a lot of money and they don't trust him. And this is the terrible thing about the film companies, they don't trust people. And so they kept badgering him, and he was slow. He was a slow director anyway. But he was looking wonderful, and we never quite finished shooting at Pinewood, and we had to pack up and go to the States with the new cut at Fox. So we're cutting away at Fox, and when we presented the film, they said, well, it seems to have a few holes in it here and there. So we had to have these meetings, and they said, the reason we've got these holes in it is because we never completed it. We never completed the shoot properly. And I said, what we need is A, B, C, D, and E. We need to do these things, and then the film will work. So after all this discussion, they said, well, then weeks later, but this just went on and on. Weeks later, you go there and have another meeting with them all, these executives. And they said, we decided we're going to do A, C, so. Fine. So they set up the whole production again, which cost a fortune. They brought the cameraman over from England again, got actors back, and we shot the bits and pieces that we thought we needed, or nearly needed. We didn't get it all. So we put it in, and they said, oh, it's much better, but it seems to have a bit missing. So eventually they did everything, but it cost a fortune. So Alien 3 became a real headache, but a nice now that Alien 3 exists as it should be, because on this set that there is around of all the Alien pictures, there is the full version, original version now. It's really worth seeing now after all this time, because it's got certain strength of its own now. It'll never be like the first one. I don't think any of them will be like the first one. Aliens was a great picture, but it was like Back to Catan. It was a different sort of film. it was the Marines. And Alien 3 tried to get back to the feeling of the first one. And I don't think I've ever seen the last one, the Resurrection. And I don't know if you'll see that.
So we heard there that Terry worked a number of times with Ridley Scott. They worked very closely together, particularly on the film Alien. And after the talk from Terry, we then had a screening of the film. Obviously, it was really interesting watching it from that perspective, having put it into context with what Terry told us about it. And Ridley Scott, talking about the film, said, I've never liked horror films before because in the end, it's always been a man in a rubber suit. Well, there's one way to deal with that. The most important thing in a film of this type is not what you see, but the effect of what you think you saw. And we could certainly see that really clearly at work in Alien, the way that he creates the tension.
Yes, I loved watching Alien projected onto the big screen again. It looked absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
And it still got its scares.
Definitely.
Still got its jump-in-your-seat moments. It was very cleverly constructed, especially once Terry had sort of talked us through how it's quite a slow-paced film.
Mm.
Lots of long shots that are going through corridors. You really do get the sense of scale with the Nostromo. But then you've got the jumps. You start to see bits of the alien slowly being put together. Its hands, its mouth, its tail, until you finally see the full thing at the end.
Yeah, and I think we were saying that actually quite a lot of the scares aren't even the alien. It's you expecting the alien to be there. And in fact, it's just that bloody cat again.
Yep.
Jones. Hiding around the corner of a box or under a chair or whatever it is. And you did wonder at some points, was it really worth risking going back for that cat with that alien lurking around? But no, I thought that was really interesting that it's withholding the alien that actually increases the tension because you're not quite sure what it is out there. You've also got, you know, the touches of the darkness, the steam billowing everywhere. So it really reduces your ability to see what's out there.
I mean, audiences at the time who'd never seen any aliens, they were going into it for the first time, seeing these little snatches of the alien, you must kind of wonder what picture they were putting together in their head.
Mm.
Now we all kind of know what the alien looks like. As the films went on, you see them almost in daylight, especially with Alien Resurrection. But at the time, it must have been absolutely terrifying, putting this picture of this creature, this slimy sort of gooey creature together.
Yeah, because obviously the first time you see anything of it is when it's bursting out of John Hurt's chest. And at the time, it's sort of that very small, almost kind of slug-like creature. And then the next time you see it, it's just a sort of hint of it. But in contrast to Brett, you see its size, you see the scale of it. But really, the actual alien itself, you see very little. It's just sort of a hint, the way that he looks upwards. Obviously gives us the idea of the size, and then you just see perhaps the tail, you see its fingers, you see its mouth, but you don't really see that overall view till perhaps only with about 25 minutes left to go.
Yeah, and it's grown, of course, as well.
Yeah.
From the tiny little slug-like thing to this giant creature.
Mm.
I'd have loved to have been there at the time and just, you know, and we got to sit with an audience as well.
Yeah.
And you sort of... The excitement, and then like bits with the cat where you suddenly go, oh, it's only the cat, and you kind of relax.
Yeah.
And then it gets you again. I absolutely loved it, and I can't, you know, I want to go on and see the other films now.
Yeah, it was great fun. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to Prometheus coming out now, having seen that so recently, and watching some of the others in between. And so, having watched Alien, which features such an iconic creature, a really iconic monster. We'd started talking about which other creatures and which other monsters had really made it into pop culture to become a sort of fixture of the way in which we think of creatures in films today. And we sort of went back into our own pasts and thought about our own favourites. Rob, what was your sort of first experience of creatures in films?
Well, I don't know about you, but my first sort of memory of this was Star Wars. We used to watch the three Star Wars films absolutely religiously. But the one that always impressed me the most amongst the many little creatures and aliens was Yoda, from Empire Strikes Back and then Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
He's clearly a puppet. But the way that they shot it, the way he talks and moves, Frank Oz did an absolutely incredible job of bringing this little character to life. There's no other way they could have done it at the time. I don't like the new CGI Yoda. I don't think it's got as much character or personality. But for me, having Yoda shuffling around on Dagobah, I think he's fantastic.
He's very sweet. He's very charismatic as a character. Yeah. And I think it's really nice, the kind of contrast between his appearance and his sort of shuffly movements and his little kind of scrunched up face. And then actually the power that he has internally. I do think perhaps the prequels kind of jumped the shark a little bit by making him suddenly be able to fight in this sort of an incredible way, which, although, I mean, it was kind of great fun, it didn't really fit with the way in which he was portrayed.
Yeah, it jarred a little for me. Yeah. It was kind of funny watching him bounce around.
But unexpected.
It was very
like a gummy bear, though, rather than a Jedi master.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that certainly with the two original films that he's in, he just steals the show almost.
Yeah, absolutely. I think certainly he makes Luke look like a bit of a bumbling fool in comparison, which is pretty impressive from a puppet. He's not my favourite Star Wars creature. I actually very, very fond of the Ewoks. I know people don't like them at all, but I think they're just so cute. I think they're very, very charming with their sort of little sort of squeaky speech and sort of hopping around a little bit. And I mean, I know they're people in suits, basically, but they're very, very cute. And I think it's really funny with the sort of worshipping C-3PO as a god and this kind of thing. And I think when I was young watching Star Wars, those were definitely the creatures that stuck with me for the longest.
Well, they were for us as well. We used to actually watch the films in the wrong order. Growing up, we used to find Empire a little bit boring, a little bit sort of quiet, and we absolutely loved the Ewoks. The bit where the walker shoots them and the Ewok gets killed and his little friend goes
really
over
sad.
And tries to shake him.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh. I thought they were great. I don't know why he's gone back and now messed with their eyes and made them blink, because they seemed
a bit creepy, actually.
Well, they seem perfectly alive at the time. I don't know why he's felt, well, it's George Lucas and he's meddling again, isn't it? So now they look even more creepy. So
I think it's hindered rather than helped. I think they were absolutely lovely as they were. You know, they certainly made me cheer for them when they were sort of fighting the Imperial Stormtroopers at the end. So
what was your first film or memory of that, if mine was Star Wars?
It was probably actually the BBC productions of Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and the Narnia stories, which when you look back on them now, which I have, I have the box set, the DVDs, the costumes are really quite dreadful for some of these creatures. The first ones that you really meet, you've got Mr. Tumnus the Fawn, where he's not done too badly, although you can see that his horns are just kind of stuck on. And then you have Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, who really are just people in giant furry suits. And if you compare it to the kind of CGI in the new Disney versions, obviously, you know, there's no comparison. But at the time, it was just absolutely magical. As a small, fairly small child watching these talking creatures, you just go with it when you're that age. And it does retain that magic for me. I'm sure if you showed it to someone for the first time now, they would probably just laugh at it. You know, you've got Aslan being acted out with a sort of animatronic head and then two people to be the front and the back, kind of like a pantomime horse. But again, at the time, it was just wonderful. You've got size effects, you've got giants, where if you look closely, they're clearly green screened to appear to be vastly bigger than they are and so on. But you know, for a small child, it really was quite spectacular.
Well, that's quite ambitious for the time.
Yeah, it was. It
yeah,
was.
Especially
it's
on a BBC
quite a long
budget.
Time ago
yeah.
when these were produced. So considering the constraints of the time, they were pretty good special effects. Mm. And it was quite a golden age for sort of creatures on TV and film. I know that some of your favourite creatures date from that kind of time on film.
Well, yes. For me, the ones that's always stuck in my mind, and I still go back today just to watch it, is Labyrinth. Written and directed by Jim Henson. There's a lot of the Muppet magic that's in that. The two that stand out for me is Ludo and Sir Didymus. We first meet Ludo when he's being tortured by the goblins. Sarah, our heroine, meets him. He looks quite monstrous, but he's actually got quite a cuddly and gentle, playful side to him. He's also one of the few creatures in the labyrinth that isn't under Jareth's control. So he's sort of a giant, sort of gangly, long arms and horns. And then when we get to the Bog of Eternal Stench, you've got Sir Didymus, who's like a fox-like terrier. He thinks he's a chivalrous knight, and he's got a big cuddly dog, Ambrosius, who he's running around on. He's a little bit cowardly, a bit like my own dog that I've got. But yeah, they're completely magical. You know that they're puppets, but once, you know, it's the mixture of actor and puppet, and they're completely believable.
Yeah, but they're quite expressive, though, aren't they, for puppets? Because it is that kind of Henson style. So that, you know, they do have the facial expressions that change, and the way that they're voiced is really great.
A lot of the times, I think it was, they would try to get, certainly with the Muppets, the puppeteer to do the voice as well, but I'm not entirely sure this is always the case in Labyrinth. But yeah, it's a totally magical world that you completely buy into, and as a kid, we absolutely adored it.
Yeah, I think that was such a good time for those type of films. I mean, as well as Labyrinth, you also had The Dark Crystal, which was pretty dark and scary. And my sister and I used to watch that. I think possibly it was a little bit on the scary side for her, but we used to really like that. And that is completely puppeteered throughout. You've got these really kind of evil creatures called the Skeksis that sort of make this very odd sort of sort of noise. It's very strange. Yeah. And they're really quite nasty, evil creatures. There's a lot of sort of sacrificing and dark magic and so on going on. But, you know, that was all sort of puppeteered. So you've got some really interesting creatures in that one. You've also got another Terry Rawlings film, Legend, which was a very similar time. And in that one, there's a young Tom Cruise as the hero, but he's sort of assisted by various fairies, sort of goblins, strange creatures and so on as they go off to do battle with the devil, as played by Tim Curry, which I thought suited him rather well.
Yes. Well, the only reference I've got to Tim Curry in Legend is a book that I used to take out. Once I'd seen Star Wars and all these sorts of films, I found this fantastic book about special effects at my local library. I can't remember for the life of me what it was called, but all I remember, it had this sort of picture of the Predator on the front.
Oh, God.
And it would talk about all the famous special effects artists that didn't get a lot of glory at the time. People like Stan Winston, who created the original Terminator effects, you know, the walking silver robots.
Yeah.
And then Rob Bottin, who created the original Robocop suit.
Right.
And also did the effects in Total Recall. And people like Rick Baker, who did the rather now famous transformation effect in American Werewolf in London.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to do the Gremlins 2. And I think he's done almost all the three now Men in Black films.
Right.
So when I was about 10, I used to take this book out religiously from the library. These are all films that I was far too young to see, but I knew of them. I think Alien was actually in there as well.
Yeah.
And it was all talking about how these creatures were created. They're all sculpted with artists. Mm. And then it was a question of how do you bring them to life? This was at the time when animatronics was all the rage. Growing up, we had the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Blokes in suits, but you had the talking heads.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously this was then going on to Henson. And I devoured this book. It was sort of a mixture of the creative side of me and also the more technical side. It then went back to talk about some of the classic techniques that we've moved on from, people like Ray Harryhausen.
Yeah, I mean, he's someone that I think is just absolutely fantastic. I do remember watching sort of Clash of the Titans, Jason and the Argonauts, when they were repeated on television when we were younger, and they really captured my imagination. I really liked the fact that this was something where, yeah, it was a very painstaking technique, but it was something that actually anyone could potentially have a go at doing. And I made some very basic stop animation films by taking photos with a normal camera and turning it into a flick book. So making models out of, or using Lego, using plasticine. The thing that really inspired me, I think, was particularly in Jason and the Argonauts, where you have the skeletons, where they sew the teeth into the ground and then uprise these skeletons out of the earth, and you see all the little sort of bones moving. And it just must have taken so much work to put all this together, to make those skeletons move in such a relatively naturalistic kind of way. And then, I mean, you've got sort of in Clash of the Titans, which is a bit more sophisticated, then you've got that magnificent clockwork owl who accompanies Perseus. She's a really kind of cute little character, kind of clicking and clacking and fluttering around. It's very sweet. And then to the other extreme, you've got Medusa with a head full of snakes, who's really quite terrifying. And it's all produced by these, you know, this really, really painstaking stop and animation process. And then, I mean, even before those, you had King Kong, of course, which for the animation is still a fantastic watch. I think when you watch the original version now, in terms of the kind of post-colonial politics of it, it is pretty appallingly stereotypical. Which I'd sort of forgotten about the tribal dancing and the masks and that side of it. And then watching it again, you have to kind of blank that out, really. But the animation is really stunning, and King Kong's facial expressions are really quite amazing. The sort of anger, but also at the end, the fear as he's attacked by the planes at the top of the Empire State Building. It's actually surprisingly moving. I mean, I also really enjoyed the newer version, the Peter Jackson version, with all the CGI animation. I think it was still very impressive. And King Kong obviously has that additional element because he's being played by Anthony Serkis, and you've got the motion capture. It brings a whole other dimension to this kind of classic monster. You've got the sort of fight sequence with the Tyrannosaurus type dinosaur, which is really, you know, very dramatic, was incredible on the big screen. And you know, I'm a big fan of Peter Jackson's work.
Well, Lord of the Rings, you had Gollum, who was completely believable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think Jackson has made such good use of that motion capture technology. And again, it's Andy Serkis again. Some people thought he ought to have been nominated for an Oscar for his motion capture portrayal of Caesar in the recent Planet of the Apes movie.
Well, yes, and you had things like Avatar, which is the same sort of thing. Your creatures, Avatar, you completely believe.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're very. That's another very clever way where they sort of lead you in very gently. You've got the human actors with an AV, and then all of a sudden you're remembering it's an animated film.
Yeah,
you don't.
Absolutely.
You completely forget that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you've got sort of Gollum in Lord of the Rings, you just go with it. The actors are reacting to him completely naturally. I mean, that must be quite a skill to look past the funny suit with all the tennis balls sticking off the sides of it, you know, and just go with it. But they do it so well. They work it in so well. And I think Gollum is such a, you know, an iconic character for me in terms of reading the books, but as well, the way in which he was brought to life in the film, I couldn't have been happier with that sort of visualization, the way in which it was done, the movements, the noises. It all just worked for me, really.
So I know that you're a big fan of The Hobbit, which will be coming out in December, first of the two films. Mm-hmm. What sort of creatures are we look forward to seeing those?
Well, it's some that are going to be a bit familiar from Lord of the Rings. So there were a lot of kind of hints and references to Bilbo's journey in The Hobbit in the Lord of the Rings already. So some of it will be familiar. For example, there'll be a group of three trolls who capture the dwarves and try and eat them. There'll be a dragon, Smaug or Smaug, depending on how you want to pronounce it, who I believe is going to be voiced by Benedict Cumberbatch,
which is quite exciting.
Very much looking forward to seeing how the dragon turns out. But also you've got characters who I really hope will be included, like Bjorn, who appears to be a man, but then when they stay at his house, he tells them to stay inside and not come out, and they see a giant bear roaming around outside during the night time. So he's not a werewolf, but he is a man, and sometimes he's a bear. I think he as part of what he eats, he has lots of beehives outside, and you know, we know bears like honey.
Oh right, yes.
And then you've got other things that are kind of nastier, much more sinister things, like the spiders of Mirkwood. Bilbo and the dwarves get sort of trapped in the middle of this horrible wood. They're trying to get a path through in order to get out to the other side, to the lonely mountain, but they can't avoid this really nasty, sort of sinister nest of spider webs. It's really kind of freaked me out when I was little, I have to say.
Is this like Shelob?
No, Shelob is kind of something different, I think. These are not giant, enormous spiders. They're bigger than normal spiders, but they're not. I mean, Shelob was kind of something on a completely different scale. Shelob is this kind of massive, gigantic creature. These are big old spiders, but you know, they are spiders.
Right,
they are mortal. Right. They're not a sort of creature of infinite darkness, which is kind of the impression you get about Shelob, the way that she's sort of repelled by the elven light and all this kind of thing. Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to seeing all of those kind of new creatures.
Mm.
Plus, we've got wargs, which are kind of like a nastier version of a wolf. And we've got the goblins. We've already met some goblins in Lord of the Rings, so I'm guessing they're going to be pretty similar to that, but we get to meet the Goblin King under the Misty Mountains. So it should be kind of lots of different interesting creatures, lots of different perils along the way, and yeah, a great big dragon at the end of it.
All right, so that sounds like something to look forward to this Christmas then.
Yeah, certainly hope so. Okay, well, those were some of our favourite creatures, and we hope you enjoyed hearing a bit from Terry Rawlings as well earlier. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at Word Adventures on Twitter, or you can comment on the blog at www.adventureswithwords.com. I've been Kate.
And I've been Rob.
Thank you very much. See you next time. Adventures with Words is brought to you by Audible. Try Audible free for 30 days and download any audiobook for free. To start your free trial, go to www.adventureswithwords.com/audible.
But first, this week we were lucky enough to go into a talk by Terry Rawlings, who is a... he's a notorious...
infamous... During his talk, he spoke...
The two that stand out for me are Ludo... Yes, the two that stand out for me is Ludo and Sir Didymus. We first meet Ludo... Try not to say Ludo. Ludo. Fucking Ludo. What is Ludo?
It's going in the outtakes.
It's going to go in the outtakes.
It's fucking Ludo.
Oh, I can't. Oh, we are explicit.
Yeah.
Right.